Welcome to the Ian Bousfield Experience. I'm glad you're here. This series of podcasts are just things that come up in my mind when I'm thinking about playing, when I'm thinking about teaching, and general thoughts about music. There's some things here that I hope you'll find really useful. And don't forget, if you've got any comments or if there's anything you want to discuss further, go to ianbousfield.com. Hello. I finally made it home. For those of you who are not aware, I've just spent the last 10 days in Denmark, in the Tivoli Gardens, the wonderful Tivoli Gardens, conducting the brass section of the Copenhagen Philharmonic in 20 festive concerts. It was 20 because of the social distancing. We were doing four a day. Congratulations to Denmark, and I think Scandinavia in general, through all of this. They've kept things as open as they possibly can, and they've realized that performing arts is part of the human disposition. Right from the very first cave paintings, the arts and music have been part of our evolution. And they are one of the few places, Denmark, Scandinavia in general, that has really recognized that live performance has to continue, not just for the performers, but for the audience. I've received so many emails from people I don't know who were in the audience to say, thank you for what you did. You know, our family really enjoyed it. So it was good. I was playing a couple of solos in each concert. So I chalked up 40 solos in 6 days, which was absolutely fantastic training to get me back doing what it is that I'm supposed to do. The first concert was a little strange, I have to admit, where I walked out and thought, what do I do now? But anyway, wonderful people in the brass section. I always, when I do projects like that, I always like to leave the place in a happier state than it was when I arrived, even if it's just because they're happy that I've gone. we had a wonderful time. But then on Monday, the curtain came down big time. New restrictions in Denmark because the graph of infections is going up vertically, and they felt they had to take drastic action. And I think they felt the only way they could do it was by extreme social distancing and closing everything down. And everyone has to make their own decisions at this time. I get the feeling that Europe is kind of closing up for Christmas. When I flew home, it was the closest thing to what I remember traveling behind the Iron Curtain, having to justify why I wanted to fly to Switzerland when I had a British passport, and having to prove that I lived in Switzerland, etc., etc. So it was, you know, it was a little bit of a tough awakening that, you know, if you live in your small bubble at the moment, you know, home, work, supermarket, home, work, supermarket, you're okay. Once you leave that, you realize what a mess we're in. Anyway, enough of the depressing stuff. On to some really fantastic, interesting stuff. I came home last night and I sat down with my wife, and we drank a bottle of 1983 Margaux, not Chateau Margaux, I'll have you know, but a lesser known Chateau from Margaux in Bordeaux, which was wonderful. And we watched a documentary on Yevgeny Mravinsky, the legendary Mravinsky of the the famous viral YouTube Shostakovich Eighth Symphony Scherzo, where he sort of moves his arms up and down about, you know, an inch at a time, and there's this amazing noise coming out. He was the mentor and the teacher, really, of Maris Janssens, and had a great influence on Valery Gergiev. And his life spanned basically the Soviet Union. He was born as an aristocrat, and I think about the age of 13, the revolution happened, and he died just before the wall came down. And it was fascinating. But I wanted to talk about one thing in particular that he said that woke me up at 5 o'clock this morning, because it was such a thought-provoking comment. He apparently said, "We don't play concerts for audiences, we play concerts for God. The audience is not important." Wow. Now, just to point out at this juncture that when I make a political statement, it doesn't mean to say that I'm affiliated to any political party. I am apolitical. And when I mention religion, it doesn't mean to say that I belong to any particular religion, but it does mean that I believe in something greater than what we can see, touch, smell, and feel around us. And I think without that belief, you can't really, I'm going to say something outrageous, you can't really be a musician. Because music is that contact into something that we know is out there that's greater than us. But it's so hard to contact. And so it woke me up at 5 o'clock this morning. We play for God. And it made me think about all of the amazing concerts that I did of Shostakovich and Prokofiev in the London Symphony when I was there. The Shostakovich that I played in the Vienna Philharmonic was not as successful. They weren't so grounded and rooted in Russian literature. They are grounded in some other areas of the repertoire, as we know. In London, in the London Symphony, by the time I got there, they had done literally thousands of concerts with the likes of Rostropovich, Shostakovich's son, Svetlanov, Simonov, Rostesvensky. And so they were totally immersed in Shostakovich. And also there were people in the orchestra who remember the times of Shostakovich. They remember that Cold War feeling. And I could totally relate to something that I heard in that documentary, which is Shostakovich at times in those wispy lines of high, cold, eerie violin melodies that seem to go on forever, that he almost brings the human spirit, the soul of humanity, into being right there and then on the stage, bringing it almost to be defined in front of us. And it made me realize that in the Russian times, in those Soviet times, it was the battle for the possession of the human soul. And it occurs to me that we may be involved in one of those right now. Again, these days, the situation with Shostakovich in Vienna, it, you know, for me, the strings were just too warm. They were too rich, and it didn't have that feeling of cold, icy cold, steely quality that you need so much. But that did happen at 5 o'clock in the morning. It made me realize. You may have heard me saying, almost jokingly, that we did a tour with Christian Thielemann with the Vienna Philharmonic of Bruckner 8. We did Bruckner 8 every night, a European tour. And in the slow movement of that, there were times when I looked up and thought, if you're ever going to come back down, now would be a very good time when I looked to the heavens, because it was almost tangible, the presence of something greater than us there on the platform with us. So the Vienna Philharmonic had its own way of achieving the same thing. Another part of the documentary was of Mravinsky rehearsing the Schubert Unfinished Symphony. And he went, da-ga-da-ga-dum. No, again. Da-ga-da-ga-dum. Again. Da-ga-da-ga-dum. In time. Da-ga-da-ga-dum. Now, add the extra bit. Da-ga-da-ga-da-ga-da-ga-dum. Da-ga-da-ga-da-ga-da-ga-dum. Now, in time, all the same articulation. Da-ga-da-ga-da-ga-da-ga-dum. taka 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 tam. And then he said, okay, let's play. And this is leads me on to George Shalty. This amazing art at the highest level. And what's the guy working on? He's working on together, all playing the same tempo with the same articulations. Is this really high art? Another video that I would encourage you to take a look at is on the Chicago Symphony Orchestra's Facebook page. And there's about a 1.5 minute clip, it won't take you long to look at, a 1.5 minute clip of Shalty rehearsing Beethoven 5. And I timed it in the first 59 seconds. 59 seconds. This unbelievable dynamo of power and energy. Explain the tempo. Dun, dun, dun. And then the... Violent. Marcato. Forte. In time, together, subdivide. And in 59 seconds, George Shalty addressed all of the issues that we all must address before we play any piece of music. Who wrote it? When was it? What's the character? What's the dynamic? What's the articulation? What's the tempo? Hold that tempo. Check that tempo. Do we get that the emotion at 104? And it brings me back to this thing that I've spoken about so many times. The lower down the musical food chain you go, the more you hear people talking about his expression, his my feeling, and the Ausstrahlung, the radiation of personality. And the higher up you go, the more you hear talking of tempo, subdivision, articulation and dynamic, and character. Now, there are some lesser developed people who have confronted me in the past who believe that I'm talking about playing music like it was being performed through a Sibelius 7 software program. Nothing could possibly be further from the truth. The mathematics enables the personality and the character and the emotion and the expression to come through. Without the mathematics, we have nothing. We are mumbling idiots. And people will not understand what we're saying. The reason why we play what's written on the page is to understand the emotion of what's written on the page. It's a guide to help us express even more. And so I would implore you really to look at this Shalty video. It's extraordinary. And I've loved showing it to my students for them to see this powerhouse of energy. Even he must have been almost 80 years old at this point. And I do ask this provocative question of my students, that is it possible that at the end of all of this, when we find out what the meaning of life really is, it's going to be a mathematical formula. Because wherever there is expression, wherever there is beauty, there is logic behind it. Through mathematics alone, of course, I can understand why people would think that I'm talking about just playing da, da, da. Nothing could be further from the truth. But without the mathematics, without the accuracy, our expression, our feeling, the beauty of this thing that is greater than us is not clear. I was recently contacted by an old friend and former student of mine who has done rather well for himself in life. He has been extremely successful in business. And the reason why he contacted me after all of these years was to say, I've been listening to your podcasts, and you know what you do, the way you talk and the way you work with students is exactly the way that we would mentor CEOs or, you know, business people, and to work and coaching on business environments. Let's see if we can put something together. And I've got very interested in this. We're going to put a plan together, and just to see whether the obvious business similarities, you know, with music, how we live with each other, how we work together, how we prepare, how we perform, our diets, how we present, can be transferred over into business. I'm fascinated by this. And one thing that came up to me, came up for me when I was thinking about, well, what do we have to offer? What is unique about the working environment that we've had, or I have experienced as a musician? And I've worked for two organizations that have been run by a top-down management, the Halle Orchestra and the university that I'm working at now, which is a very clear hierarchical management system. And I've worked for two organizations that have been self-run, the London Symphony Orchestra and the Vienna Philharmonic. And I consider myself very lucky to have spent the majority of my orchestral career working for self-governing orchestras. And one thing that did occur to me was, I was going to call this part of the podcast "Where Margaret Thatcher Got It Wrong." In the 1980s, when Margaret Thatcher came to power in the UK as Prime Minister, she made it her goal to break the unions. The word "break" was used. I'm going to break the unions. Now, there's a tangible reason for this. In the 1970s, I remember we had power three nights of the week. The other two, it was turned off because, a little bit like in France, every time a union goes on strike, they start parking their tractors in Paris. It seems to me like every union's got its own stack of tractors. Even the teachers seem to drive tractors when they go on strike. And it was kind of out of control in the 1970s. And so we're going to bring the unions back under control. Coal miners wouldn't supply power, etc., etc. It was the coal miners, really, that Margaret Thatcher wanted to break the most, and resorted to lots of skull breaking, dressing soldiers up in police uniforms, all of that kind of thing. And I guess this is a statement. I know people who were around in the 1980s and saw all of this happen, and they still voted Conservative in the last election, which defies me, but there you go. And so this is like, where did she get it wrong? Well, I think she went about it the wrong way, and I'll tell you why. It's based on my experience of playing in self-governing orchestras. Nobody ever treats musicians worse than other musicians. Not conductors, not managements. If you want to improve the quality of your product, put the people who are producing that product in control of the quality. If the success of their organization and therefore their rewards is success-based, you bet there won't be any slackers. You bet there won't be anyone turning up to work late. You bet there won't be anyone not practicing their part, because they will get nailed by their colleagues, because, hey, this is for our institution. This is for our organization. In London, the quality of performance at one point was like, well, we need to have the best product so that we get all of the film music, we get all of the recording sessions, etc., etc. And in Vienna, they felt very much the weight, the pressure of being one of the top orchestras in the world. You could feel it, particularly when we went to Carnegie Hall, Suntory Hall, these kind of things. It's like, hey, we're supposed to be right at the top, and the pressure was really, really tangible. And if someone wasn't pulling the weight, as compassionate as they were, it was like, hey, we have to make this work. And so did Margaret Thatcher need to address the issue with the unions? Without question. Was breaking them the most successful way of doing it? I don't think so. I actually don't think so. I think if she'd empowered them and just said, look, stop coming to me saying you want more of this and supporting this person, you know, this person deserves to be fired. You know that they haven't been doing their job. You know, et cetera, et cetera. Why are you defending them? How can you? You know, if a union is just a one-sided defense of their members, whatever their level of behavior or performance is, then it's a lame duck, isn't it? It has to remain, it has to keep, stay reasonable and be based in reality. So that would be my thing for business. If you want to get the quality of a product up, put it in the hands of the people who are delivering that product. That's what I learned. That's what I learned in London and Vienna. You know, if a conductor was mean to you one week, they were going to go the next week. The guy who sits in front of you is going to be sitting there next week and next month and next year. So, but that leads me quite conveniently on to, if you like, a union-based thing. There was a big move when I was in London away from unionism, de-unionizing everything. And I was one of those people who, I mean, although I still am a member of the British Musicians Union and have been since I was 16 years old, I was one of those for de-unionizing things, I guess, you know, because it seemed outdated, and that was very much the fashion then. But have we shot ourselves in the foot? Have we done something really stupid? And I'll tell you why. You know, the unions were like, no, you can't record that. No, you can't take this for news purposes. No, you can't video our rehearsal. Are you going to pay us to video our rehearsal? Are we going to get paid? How much are you going to pay us when this CD gets sold? How much are you going to pay when it gets played on the radio? Sounds very mercenary, but actually it's our business acumen. I was talking to Christine Jacob from Domaine Lucien Jacob in Burgundy, and they are great winemakers, and they've sold out. They've sold out. In these lockdowns, what have people done? They've gone home, they've watched films, they've listened to music, they've cooked, and they've bought wine, and they've sold out because they're great, and their product deserves to sell. So what has been others' misfortune in restaurants and et cetera, the wine producers are doing really well. The good ones. Now just imagine if we as musicians had been sitting here now saying, well, it's a shame the concerts didn't happen, but boy, my royalty check this year is going to be amazing on the CD sales and the downloads. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, we gave it away. We've given our business acumen away. What used to be paid out to us in measly royalties is now taken by 5 or 6 billionaires. And we missed the chance. And the union was not wrong. We gave it away. And that's quite a salutary comment with which to end this brief but powerful podcast. But let's think on that. What did we do? We gave it away. It started out in the 1970s with buyout rates for films, so you didn't get royalties, which was why Hollywood liked recording in London, because they didn't have to pay royalties. And so in 1974, the basic rate for a film session in London was £150. £150. That's how they persuaded people not to take the royalties. That was where it started. And if I remember rightly, I think the film session in London now, 46 years later, is £150. I don't think it's changed. And in the meantime, we've had our product taken away from us. And I think it's time for us to say, hey, that's ours. That's our product. You've taken it. The rights to these recordings and things over the years should really belong to us. And it may be too late to get the genie back in the bottle, but I think we have to try.
So there you go. I hope you enjoyed that. If there are any issues that you found particularly interesting, don't forget to contact me, and always go to ianbousfield.com for lots more interesting stuff.